Welcome to session 374. This is a dual paper session entitled Purposeful Strangers, Examining Ex-Mormon Narratives and the Reasons People Give for Leaving the Church. We have two panelists. The first is Seth Payne, who is a recent graduate of Yale Divinity School, where he graduated magna cum laude with an emphasis on political and theological ethics. While at Yale, Seth developed a love for Mormon studies and was able to devote a significant amount of his research to topics related to Mormonism. Seth is also co-founder and organizer, along with Richard Bushman, Ariel Bybee Lawton, and Taylor Petrie, of the Faith and Knowledge Conference series. These conferences are devoted to LDS graduate students in religious studies and focus on the place of religious scholarship in the larger context of Mormon faith. A second panelist is Ryan Wimmer, who has a BA in history from the University of Utah and is working on a Master of Arts in History at the University of Utah. He's currently a second lieutenant in the National Guard. Some of the historical research he has done, both independently and for school, has been the development of Mormon theology, Nauvoo polyandry, the relationship between the Japanese and Utahns during World War II, and many other topics pertaining to both Mormon and Utah history. He served an LDS mission, has been married for 8 years, and grew up in West Valley City. Now lives in Magna, Utah. Before we begin the session, I kindly ask that you turn off all cell phones and pagers. Seth?
Thank you. I wonder if before I begin, if I could ask for a volunteer to run my slides. I didn't realize the projector would be so far away from where I would be. Thank you. There's a copy of my paper there, so if you follow along, there's an actual picture of the slide where I... So it should be pretty apparent. I appreciate that. Yeah, the laptop's just right there at the table. So, yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. There's some things included on the slides that I don't explicitly mention in the paper, which I think are important and beneficial. The modern LDS Church is simultaneously lauded as an all-American, pro-democratic beacon of religious and political conservatism, suspected of being merely a large corporate shell interested in the growth not only of its membership roles but also in its balance sheet, and held in contempt largely by evangelicals and other conservative Christians who find both the doctrines and practices of Mormonism cultish at best and nefarious at worst. Nowhere is Mormonism's schizophrenic social position more evident than in the narratives of those who were once Mormon but have since left the LDS Church. The personal exit from any organization, especially those which are socially controversial, tends to produce a very specific type of narrative, which gives an account of an individual's experience within and eventual withdrawal from an organization. This is especially true in the case of modern Mormonism. Vocal and seemingly motivated ex-Mormons produce and disseminate exit narratives, often written in the context of pop psychological terminology such as recovery, i.e. recovery from Mormonism, which describes in various ways their victimization at the hands of Mormonism generally and their subsequent movement from being victims to victors. Indeed, an entire ex-Mormon movement has emerged in the past decade, developing its own unique social structure, language, and culture in the process. Ex-Mormonism, as it were, has long existed as a subset of a larger and largely evangelical counter-cult movement. This latest ex-Mormon iteration, however, is characterized by its mostly secular focus and distrust, if not outright rejection, of not only LDS doctrinal literalism, but most forms of religious conservatism as well. Recent ex-Mormon narratives do not generally describe a process of what sociological literature would describe as leave-taking or switching. Rather, they describe a fundamental shift away from what is perceived as a rigid literalism to an unbounded scientific rationality. In this sense, members of the emerging ex-Mormon movement should be sociologically considered apostates, although I hesitate to employ this label due to the extremely negative connotations this word has within the LDS community. Therefore, I wish to make it clear that throughout this presentation, I use this word apostate purely in its technical sense and in no way intend to attach inherent negative connotations to its meaning. The use of a word such as apostate in light of its significance and meaning in LDS history and culture may lead some to oversimplify what appear to be complex notions and descriptions of social and cultural estrangement found within the narratives of ex-Mormons, and therefore I urge listeners to avoid the temptation to hear and interpret this word in its non-technical and LDS-specific context. This paper will examine the ex-Mormon narrative as narrative and will attempt to glean from this very specific literary form insights into the culture of contemporary ex-Mormonism. This paper is not an attempt to explain the specific reasons why individuals leave or have left the LDS Church, as will be discussed shortly. After-the-fact narratives are inherently unreliable in establishing the authenticity of actual occurrence. Rather, this presentation seeks to explore the complex culture and mood of said narratives and identify areas and issues in need of further research and study. This presentation is framed in the context of abstract sociological literature dealing with the nature of religious apostasy. Accordingly, I will begin by presenting a very brief overview of relevant sociological theory and will attempt to place Mormonism, and particularly the modern LDS Church, within this larger conceptual framework. David Bromley identifies three types of organizations and classifies them according to the degree to which their interests coincide with other organizational units in their respective environmental fields. These include allegiant, contestant, and subversive organizations, respectively. Bromley observes that all types of organizations experience some rate of participant exodus, and exiting participants are a potentially important source of information that could be used to discredit the organization. Therefore, organizations have incentive to control or manage the exit process of members as much as possible. Bromley argues that whatever the nature of individual or situational motivations, organizations in the low-tension positions are most likely to be able to control the exit process as to prevent public dispute, while organizations in high-tension positions are much less likely to be able to do so. Thus, Bromley identifies three distinctive contested exit roles, defector, whistleblower, and apostate, that are characteristic of allegiant, contestant, and subversive organizations, respectively. Each type of exit has its own unique set of characteristics and produces its own type of narrative. Most relevant to our discussion here, however, is Bromley's description of the apostate role as it relates to subversive organizations. Unlike defectors and whistleblowers, apostates undertake a total change of loyalties by aligning with one or more elements of an oppositional coalition without the consent or control of the organization. Thus, the apostate narrative is one which documents the quintessentially evil essence of the apostate's former organization, chronicled through the apostate's personal experience of capture and ultimate escape and rescue. Due to a polarized situation and power imbalance, there is considerable pressure on individuals exiting subversive organizations to negotiate a narrative with the oppositional coalition that offers an acceptable explanation for participation in the organization and for now once again reversing loyalties. The most common apostate narrative can be classified as captivity narrative, in which apostates assert that they were innocently or naively operating what they had every reason to believe was a normal, secure social site, were subjected to overpowering subversive techniques, endured a period of subjugation during which they experienced tribulation and humiliation, ultimately effected escape or rescue from the organization, and subsequently renounced their former loyalties and therefore issue a public warning of the dangers of the former organization as a matter of civic responsibility. Upon exiting a subversive organization, apostates assume a newly constructed role which places them in a position which is diametrically opposed to their former beliefs and commitment. Consequently, the apostate seeks to polarize the former and present identities, accentuating a personal transformation akin to conversion, and the intensity and zeal in which the apostate embraces the new moral vision, seeks atonement through public confession and testimony, and makes salvific claims of redemption, suggests that the ex-member's new affiliation may be analyzed as a type of quasi-religious conversion in its own right. Indeed, it is typically characterized as a darkness-to-light transformation. We can utilize Bromley's typology in two distinct ways when considering the LDS Church. First, in what I term the historical progression model, and second, by employing what I have labeled the societal segment analysis. Armin Moss, in his book The Angel and the Beehive, gives a thorough account of the LDS Church's social positioning through time, society's reaction to this positioning, and the various levels of tension which have existed at various stages of LDS Church development. In general, the LDS Church has gone from being considered a highly subversive organization, due mostly to plural marriage and fears of tyrannical leadership dynamics from 1830 to the early 1900s, to experiencing high levels of assimilation through the 1950s, and has more recently, through what Moss calls a retrenchment motif, assumed a position somewhere between allegiant and contestant, perhaps closer to the latter. The use of the historical progression model is extremely useful if we are attempting to identify modern Mormonism within a static position along Bromley's organizational typology. Clearly, the LDS Church would fit, as Moss has indicated, between the contestant and allegiant organizational types due to the moderate to low tensions experienced in general with society at large. Yet we must also recognize that there are some segments of society which view the modern LDS Church as highly subversive. It is from these segments that ex-Mormon apostate narratives emerge and demonstrate characteristics of Bromley's proposed narrative structure. The modern LDS Church simultaneously produces the three types of exits Bromley has identified, namely defectors, those whom we would call less active Latter-day Saints, whistleblowers, best characterized by groups such as the Mormon Alliance, and apostates, former Mormons who align themselves with oppositional coalitions who are set against Mormonism in one way or another. Evangelical Mormon critics find the modern LDS Church subversive on mostly theological grounds. They reason that because the beliefs and practices of the Church are so beyond what could be considered traditional Christianity, that individual Mormons are in spiritual danger, and that their eternal souls are in jeopardy. Consequently, these groups generally are formed as ministries to help witness to Mormons about the real Jesus in an effort to bring them out of Mormonism. Secular Mormon critics have no singular focus or uniting motive to match the intent and zeal of evangelicals. Richard Packham, the founder of the Ex-Mormon Foundation, is an avowed atheist and thus has no theological motive. However, he has stated that he believes some results of Mormon doctrine and culture can be considered evil. Therefore, his aim, and in broad terms the purpose of the foundation, is to help people wishing to leave the church transition out of Mormonism into leading normal lives in a purely secular sense. It is from these two distinct groups, the evangelical and secular Mormon critics, which view the modern LDS church as subversive, that the LDS apostate narratives emerge. Rather than simply transition out of Mormonism or become inactive or less active, ex-Mormon apostates make a conscious and clear break with the LDS Church as an institution and align with either theological or secular oppositional coalitions to the process of narrative production. Loosely speaking, the writing of a narrative serves as a kind of a rite of passage, wherein authors become members of a newfound community. The construction of such narratives for admittance into a new community is not surprising. In Bromley's conceptual framework, the Ex-Mormon Foundation and their theological counterparts are the oppositional coalitions to the LDS Church, and thus, upon rendering an acceptable narrative, these groups accept pledges and tests of loyalty of profession and professions of regret as the basis for reintegration into social networks to which they control access. Of course, in this case, such requirements are certainly not explicit, but very often becoming part of the Ex-Mormon community, be it theological or secular, begins with some sort of narrative production. With this general sociological and societal framework in mind, we can now look closely at the ex-Mormon narratives in detail. It is a fascinating sociological phenomenon that the narratives of both entry and exit from religious movements are mirror images of one another. Both describe the circumstances and context which brought about an eventual epiphany which led either into or out of a particular organization. When analyzing the ex-Mormon narrative, it is essential to place the narrative in the proper sociological context. Several researchers have pointed out the inherent unreliability of apostate narratives in establishing fact. Daniel Johnson goes as far to say that substantial portions of apostate accounts, indeed, perhaps even entire accounts, have nothing to do with real-world happenings or experiences. Johnson's conclusions come from his analysis of anti-Catholic narratives in the 19th century, which were produced when the Catholic Church was considered highly subversive by American society at large. In such an extreme anti-Catholic atmosphere, it is not surprising that Catholic apostates were able to construct narratives containing blatant fabrications, because during this time there were essentially no defenders of the Catholic Church to question these narratives or act as a check on their reliability. Such was the case also with late 19th century Mormonism as well. when wild apostate narratives were produced and widely accepted because Mormonism had no societal credibility and the public was eager to believe anything negative or salacious about the church. Probably the best example of this would be the fair maidens being trapped in the top rooms of the Salt Lake Temple for those evil polygamists and then jumping to safety in the Great Salt Lake. That'd be a long jump. But such stories were told. Such is not the case with modern Mormonism. First, there is an entire industry of Mormon apologetics which has sprung up to counter both anti-Mormon claims and ex-Mormon narratives. Additionally, individual Mormons have become successful and admired members of society, and therefore the public is generally more skeptical of wild claims made against the church. In general, the Mormon exit narratives which originate from secular anti-Mormon sources are less likely to contain blatant narrative fabrications, while those produced by members of theological anti-Mormon groups are more likely to contain fabrications which further the narrative's evangelical purpose. Even if, however, we determine that a narrative is more or less likely to contain blatant fabrication, we must not look to the narrative as a source of actual fact, but rather consider them as only part of a much larger picture. Lewis Carter points out that believers are much more likely to minimize or ignore negative traits in a community, while apostates are more likely to identify negative traits which the group does not, in fact, exhibit. It is for this reason that I am not attempting to establish fact or reach conclusions on real-world happenings from this study. Rather, I am looking to these ex-Mormon narratives as cultural signposts which provide insight into ex-Mormonism itself, rather than as definitive indicators of specific problems within modern Mormonism. These narratives are not sufficiently explanatory of the reasons why individuals exit Mormonism, and therefore any attempt to construe the data presented here to reach this type of conclusion would be extremely misguided. This is not to suggest that the reasons for leaving Mormonism as given in these narratives are inauthentic or untrue. However, in order to reach the conclusion that such reasons are substantive, the data presented here must be validated by further sociological study. This study should be considered preliminary or a pilot study. The data presented here represent only the narratives directly considered by the study. Therefore, the data is not meant to be extrapolated to apply to all ex-Mormon narratives. The sources used in the study were selected neither randomly nor screened for bias. A total of 136 narratives were collected and analyzed for the study. A corresponding list of narrative elements was created simultaneously to represent the content or themes of each narrative. Ultimately, 145 unique narrative elements were identified. As each narrative was read and analyzed, it was associated with corresponding elements. Thus, there is a one-to-many relationship between narratives and elements. All narratives were selected from online collections, including exmormon.org, concernedchristians.com, and lifeafter.org. Recovery from Mormonism, which I will hereafter refer to as RFM, had the largest collection of narratives or stories. I was able to identify and extract 111 unique narratives from the main sections of the RFM board. Stories collected from Concerned Christians and Life After Ministries are much shorter and more focused than those narratives found at RFM. Not surprisingly, these narratives are formulaic and clearly written with the mission of the host organization in mind. Concerned Christians and Life After Ministries both state explicitly that their goal is to convert Mormons to the real Jesus, whereas RFM's stated goals are more support-oriented rather than evangelical. It is important to note that I reviewed the RFM narratives first, followed by the Life After and Concerned Christian narratives. Also, that I did not recognize or find blatant narrative fabrications until reviewing the Life After and Concerned Christian narratives. This is not to suggest that the RFM narratives do not contain inaccuracies or possible misrepresentations, but rather that the evangelical narratives at times introduce blatant fabrications to further the purpose of the narrative and to reinforce the narrative's overriding evangelical themes. RFM narratives do not possess any consistent and overriding organizational theme, and therefore fabrications of this kind would be superfluous. Blatant fabrications appear to be absent from the RFM narratives, yet are present in nearly 25% of the evangelical narratives examined for this study. The narratives examined in this study each exhibit a similar structure and format and contain several common elements regardless of their source. There are several possible reasons for this common structure. In the case of RFM, narratives Narrative authors are likely highly influenced by reading other narratives, and thus the stories posted in 1995 and 1996 during the genesis of the site likely established a pattern for later narratives. Likewise, the evangelical narratives were written with a very specific purpose in mind and consequently are structured as testimonials, which serve the overall purpose of the hosting ministry. A second possibility for the common narrative structure is that ex-Mormons do in fact share a common experience in exiting the church. I suspect that both factors come into play in the construction of ex-Mormon narratives. To me, most of the narratives reviewed in this study possess an air of authenticity, which I judge by my years of involvement with the LDS Church and those marginal to it. Thus, while the format and structure of these narratives may be somewhat artificial, I believe that the general feeling behind the accounts and the described process of apostasy is very likely to be authentic. These narratives generally begin with some sort of introduction which states the purpose for writing and serves to legitimize the story which will follow. The author often states how long he or she was a member of the LDS Church, if he or she was a convert or born into the church, and if born into the church will often cite LDS pioneer ancestry. Additionally, the author may make mention of callings or positions they held or provide other indications of their activity level while a Latter-day Saint. In addition to specific church callings, this may include mention of seminary or institute attendance, full-time missionary service, or matriculation at Brigham Young University. The narrative introduction often sits in sharp contrast to what comes later. The author generally wants to make it clear that at one point they were fully in Mormonism and now they are completely out. Yet while the author wants to illustrate that they were once fully Mormon, they also want to provide an explanation for why they once accepted beliefs which they now find completely absurd. In a sense, authors offer an apology or an explanation for why they were once part of the LDS belief system. Also, authors often point out feelings of long-term discontent within Mormonism. For those authors who were born or raised LDS, they often include statements that a testimony of Mormon belief was never received, or that the credibility of a spiritual witness, the key component of any Mormon testimony, should be seriously doubted. Nearly 50% of the narratives reviewed included some sort of indication that while the author may have been fully active within Mormonism, they never fully accepted LDS beliefs. Of course, of equal importance is that 50% of these narratives do not describe such long-term doubts or discomfort, and thus I want to caution against the temptation to oversimplify these narratives by concluding that individual exits are driven mainly by a lack of personal testimony or conviction. Those authors who were converts to the LDS Church often explain that at the time they joined Mormonism, they were emotionally vulnerable from divorce, abuse, or some similar life-altering event, and were taken in by the kindness of Mormon missionaries or LDS Church members. In fact, nearly 44% of the authors which identified themselves as converts made a point to emphasize that they were vulnerable at the time of their conversion. Overall, these statements of long-term discontent and vulnerability function as a genesis for the author's account of the exit process and provide context for explaining how and why the exit process began. When I began the study, I expected that doctrinal issues or problems would be the driving force behind these exit narratives and the point of their focus, that somehow specific issues of LDS Church history or claims of scriptural literalism would force people to reconsider their faith in the face of difficult and daunting questions. What I found, however, is that most of these narratives deal directly with issues of cultural pressure and disengagement, and that the narrative authors generally address specific doctrinal concerns only in an after-the-fact manner. Additionally, the narratives focus on the results of discovering doctrinal difficulties, generally feelings of hurt, confusion, and anger, rather than on the doctrinal or historical issues themselves. The evangelical narratives were much more likely to focus on specific doctrinal claims or disagreements, mostly citing how the LDS Church doctrine is unbiblical. But even these narratives expressed that a sense of spiritual emptiness or cultural disenfranchisement was the beginning of their exit out of Mormonism. It is important to keep in mind, however, that while the majority of these narratives describe a period of disenfranchisement, there were those narratives which described exiting Mormonism for purely doctrinal reasons. I would contend, however, that since strict orthodoxy, or at least the appearance thereof, is such a large part of LDS culture, that when individuals adopt or confront heterodox views, they feel tremendous cultural pressure to either reconfirm their beliefs or hide their doubts. Either choice seems to be untenable. In this way, it can be said that even concerns which begin as purely doctrinal or historical are likely to lead to some feelings of cultural pressure and disengagement at some point. That these narratives would express such descriptions of cultural disenfranchisement is not surprising. Generally speaking, LDS culture is very specific in its requirements, and there are clear, if not explicit, expectations of what a Mormon should be. It is a common assumption within the LDS Church that Mormons become apostates because of their desire to violate certain commandments, which are part of the LDS cultural norm, including abstinence from premarital sex, the avoidance of tea and alcohol, coffee and tea, tobacco, etc. Naturally, members who violate these norms will find themselves somewhat separate from Mormon culture and left with feelings of estrangement. Some of this type of estrangement is described in these narratives. However, most descriptions of cultural estrangement are linked with issues of thought or belief rather than specific violations of behavioral norms. Additionally, modern Mormon culture is theologically centered on the concepts of marriage and the nuclear family. Therefore, those within Mormonism who do not easily fit into these norms and expectations may find themselves culturally estranged. Mormon culture also places much emphasis on acquiescence to authority and respect for a rigid hierarchical structure. Therefore, some narratives express frustration at what is perceived to be the suppression and discouragement of free thought in individual members by church hierarchy. One author recounts how he was disciplined by a local state president for writing to church headquarters expressing disagreement with the church's political involvement in China. The author reports that he was repeatedly told by his state president that, quote, the brethren hold the keys, and therefore their decisions, even political decisions, are sanctioned by the Lord, and that he, as a member of the church, had no right to express disagreement. Each narrative, in one way or another, expresses some sort of cultural estrangement between the individual and Mormon culture at large, which occurs either before or after the author discovers Mormon doctrinal and historical challenges. A widely held belief among some active Latter-day Saints is that apostates leave the church because they are offended by leaders or other members. The narratives examined here lend support, at least in part, to that perception. Nearly 34% of narrative authors report having had a negative experience with other church members who, for one reason or another, made them feel unwelcome, unworthy, or otherwise excluded from the church community. Additionally, this includes accounts of the author observing or becoming aware of what they judge to be hypocritical behavior on the part of members of the LDS Church. Other narratives report feelings of guilt or confusion over central LDS worship, mostly in regard to LDS temple practices. From a young age, Mormons are encouraged to look forward to the day when they can worship and eventually marry in the temple. 32% of the narratives reported discomfort with either their first temple experience or temple participation in general. Of these, most describe the temple experience as being odd, unspiritual, and even upsetting. It is unclear how many authors experienced the pre-1990 temple endowment versus the more modern version. Discomfort with other key tenets of Mormon doctrine, including the position that the LDS Church is God's one true church, and that a testimony of the truth of its claims can be found or obtained through a spiritual experience, is also a common theme in these narratives. For example, one author reports that while serving a full-time mission in a Central American country, that he was confused by the seemingly authentic spiritual experience of a man who felt that he should not accept Mormon claims and join the LDS Church. This author's missionary companion explained that this man had simply been deceived by Satan, but the author felt that the man had experienced a genuine revelation from God. Thus the question, how can Mormonism be the one true church if non-Mormons experience authentic spiritual experiences confirming the truth of their faiths? For those authors to whom faith is still important, they interpret these spiritual experiences as general expressions of God's love, and not as a confirmation of specific truth claims. However, most evangelicals, as well as RFM authors, express significant doubt as to the validity of such spiritual confirmations of truth, and explain them as being merely emotional responses. Evangelicals maintain that truth is to be found in the Bible, while secular authors express confidence in reason and science. Other authors report feeling culturally estranged because they were homosexual or held a strong feminist ideology, two issues in which the modern LDS Church has adopted conservative doctrinal and social positions. A few female authors expressed that they felt unimportant because they were unmarried and had no children. In general, it seems that all narrative authors were in some way marginal to Mormon culture. Of course, whether this represents genuine experience or is the product of narrative creation process is a question worthy of further study. The discussion of doctrinal issues and specific LDS truth claims is present in nearly all of the narratives, but is generally proffered as an after-the-thought recitation. It is often the case that Tanner history, and by that I mean Gerald and Sandra Tanner type history, is accepted and reported, while the nuance of Michael Quinn or Todd Compton history is lost, at least in the narrative. This recitation generally follows the discussion of cultural estrangement and in many cases functions in the narrative to justify or validate the estrangement described previously. In only rare cases are doctrinal concerns and problems described as the singular genesis of the exit process. Rather, doctrinal and historical issues function to solidify or widen the gap between the author and Mormonism. However, doctrinal and historical concerns do seem to produce the most anger and frustration in the narratives because they evoke a sense of betrayal in the author. Such angst can be described thusly. An author has been taught a particular version of church history or has built a conceptual worldview based on LDS truth claims only to discover that, at least in the author's mind, he or she has been lied to regarding to key elements of Mormon history and doctrine. The author generally blames church leadership for the supposed cover-up and is apt to describe the whole affair in conspiratorial terms. It is this perceived cover-up which creates the vitriolic and often irrational criticism which is present not only in some of these narratives, but also in parts of the RFM community as well. By decrying a supposed LDS church conspiracy and cover-up, some of these narrative authors actually create or speculate on secret church motives and begin to interpret every church action, both past and present, in terms of this conspiratorial framework. The adoption of this conspiratorial framework may impede or prevent a complete understanding of some of the issues at hand. Interestingly, I became the subject of a conspiracy theory after attending the Ex-Mormon Conference in Salt Lake City in October 2007. During an open microphone session period, I rose to express my regret at how some active LDS members had treated those who have left the church, and to tell attendees a bit about my ongoing research. I mentioned that I had discussed some of my preliminary findings with some in church leadership, in particular my dismay at how poorly it seems ex-Mormons have been treated by friends and family while leaving the church, and that those leaders' almost universal response to me was that we need to have quote-unquote big arms in the church to welcome and accept those with disparate experiences and beliefs. I was hastily shouted down by some conference attendees before conference organizer Sue Emmett made a plea that I be heard out, but eventually it became very apparent that what I had to say was not to be received in that environment. I suppose it illustrates more my how naive I was to try and say that at that particular place. At the conclusion of the conference, an attendee posted his belief online at postmormon.com that I had been sent as a spy by LDS church leadership to keep tabs on the growing ex-Mormon movement. Of course, had I actually been a spy, I suppose getting up during the open microphone session and announcing my presence was not likely a wise choice. Of course, I do not want to leave the impression that such wild conspiratorial views are characteristic of the ex-Mormon Foundation or its membership generally. They are simply expressed quite vigorously by a few and go largely unchecked. I found most people in attendance at the conference to be very kind and sincere with a genuine interest in my work and a willingness to share their experiences. Many individuals approached me after the open microphone session to express their regret at how I was received, most notably Sandy Crane, at the time the Foundation's president. And they engaged me in what I considered to be meaningful dialogue, which I found both moving and profoundly helpful. Again, what is of interest here is the violent emotional reaction that these narrative authors seem to experience once they learn of doctrinal and historical problems in the LDS Church, and also the deep feelings of anger and resentment and disillusionment that comes with traditional LDS views that this realization tends to produce. Of course, this type of reaction is not to be completely unexpected, as the majority of narrative authors have had some of their very basic assumptions, which have informed their worldview, changed, challenged, and completely undermined. In such circumstances, it is easy to see why many authors experience a violent emotional backlash. The final component of each of these narratives is an expression of gratitude for newfound freedoms or beliefs. In fact, it's amazing how similar the open microphone session is at an ex-Mormon conference to what we see in Fasten Testimony Meeting. Often, authors will report that their time in Mormonism was a time of being trapped or controlled, and that now they have rejected Mormon claims and embraced a new worldview, that they experienced freedom and pleasures previously unknown. In this way, 40% of all narratives examined can be classified as traditional apostate captivity narratives. Certainly, these captivity narratives, as I've mentioned before, are not as extreme as those written when Mormonism was universally considered subversive. However, these modern narratives have adopted the language of Western Orthodoxy in espousing the merits of individuality, freedom, and reason, contrasting these values with the stifling overbearance of the modern LDS Church. As these authors were once trapped, now they are free. This study should focus our attention on the social and cultural estrangement aspects of Mormon apostasy first and foremost. As I have illustrated above, the narratives themselves seem to be driven by an estrangement process, both doctrinal and social. I believe that we, as liberal and intellectual Mormons, are partially to blame for perpetuating these feelings of estrangement. For too long, we have been marginal to Mormon culture and have conceived of ourselves as the other. In many cases, we have defined ourselves by what we are not and by what we do not believe, rather than as what we are and by what truths we have found. Rather than positively affirm our faith, we have often sought identity through the discovery and adoption of heterodox views. The irony, of course, is that the whole notion of orthodoxy is anathema to Mormonism. There is no such thing as orthodoxy, but merely the perception thereof. Regardless of any particular truth claim or its so-called validity, there is one observable and tangible, yet amazingly silent reality. In our midst, there are those who struggle and suffer with their faith. There are those who feel alone and isolated, and whose worldviews are shattering, regardless of how much they fast, pray, hold family home evening, or read the Book of Mormon. These saints often feel as if they are alone. At first glance, Mormonism may give off the appearance of a homogeny of culture and belief. Yet there is a strong undercurrent of lively discussion, debate, and belief, conversation involving a wide range of Latter-day Saints who may or may not accept all of modern Mormonism's unique truth claims. I believe that we, who are engaged in this conversation, are called to make our faith manifest to kindred spirits, to validate their struggle, to share our experiences, our doubts, and our love. Recently, one first-time attendee of Sunstone West commented on his blog, quote, "Sunstone attendees treated me exactly the way we hope and ask ward members to treat all newcomers," unquote. Let us extend that experience beyond the walls of this symposium. Let us, in our unique and individual ways, seek out those who need and want to hear our perspective and testimony. May I be so bold as to call such an effort Mormon neoliberalism? Within the narratives reviewed for this study, it seems that the authors believe they were presented with an either-or, black and white choice: accept Mormonism and all of its truth claims, or completely reject it. Yet many at this conference and symposium are examples of those Latter-day Saints who do not reject Mormonism altogether, but revel in its paradoxes, contradictions, and challenges. These narratives would seem to indicate that a possible difference between the ex and liberal Mormon may be the degree to which each perceives his or her own individual latitude of belief within Mormonism at large, as well as their ability to perceive Mormonism as what Armin Moss has called a human institution with its inherent strengths, weaknesses, and struggles. Therefore, in conclusion, may I suggest again that those of us who consider ourselves Mormon liberals or intellectuals come out of the shadows, as it were, and assume a pastoral role for those who may become ex-Mormon. By existing and behaving as a subculture, rather than as an integral part of the larger Mormon tapestry of experience, we contribute to the myth of Mormon orthodoxy. By this, I mean that every Latter-day Saint struggles with their faith, prefers some doctrines over others, and ultimately forms a unique worldview informed but not strictly defined by LDS theology. Certainly, some of our brothers and sisters will find that they are more comfortable outside the church. We will certainly miss them. However, many who struggle are seeking a reason to stay, to retain their heritage, and develop a faith which is informed by their Mormon roots. I am not fully sure how this pastoral effort should be carried out. I suppose that each of us find ourselves in vastly different circumstances with local priesthood leaders who demonstrate varying levels of tolerance for liberal expression in their words and stakes. As members of the body of Christ, we must respect the jurisdiction and views of local priesthood leaders, regardless of how well those views correlate with our own. Certainly, the past 15 years have shown us that strong, in-your-face advocacy can be counterproductive and ultimately hurtful. In any circumstance, however, I believe it is possible to reach out in appropriate and meaningful ways. It saddens me to see so many good and wonderful people leave the body of the church because they may feel the pressure of a false choice between orthodoxy and heterodoxy. As Joseph Smith said, "I want the liberty of believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled." Let us who have experienced or who are currently experiencing our own challenges of faith reach out to our fellow Latter-day Saints who struggle, and let them know that they, just as Joseph Smith and indeed every Latter-day Saint, have the liberty to believe as they choose and remain in good company with the saints. Thank you.
Many people leave the church for different reasons and take many different paths. The purpose of this paper is to discuss some of the reasons people leave and the different paths they take. My main focus will be on why I believe there seems to be a trend in modern times that most modern dissenters seem to become either atheist or agnostic. I say seem due to the fact that there really has not been a credible statistical study about why people leave the church and where they go. I have seen one that claimed that 45% of those that leave become atheists or agnostic, but it didn't really sound like a credible report. Nor do I see how such a poll could be taken worldwide, since I assume most dissenters remain generally anonymous. There is also the fact that many who call themselves ex-Mormon may have never actually taken the time out of their life to be formally excommunicated. Determining how many people think of themselves as ex-Mormon is next to impossible. Let me state that this paper is not necessarily a sophisticated research project like what you just heard. It is based on reading ex-Mormon narratives and the many conversations I've had with ex-Mormons, both personally and online on discussion boards. It is also a reflection of the many issues that I myself have faced in my own spiritual journey. There are people that do leave the church and do find another faith. Those that do leave the church and become evangelical or Protestant, it is concern over sin that generally leads them down this path. Is this mine? One recent individual has shared this type of story, Sean McCraney. Sean McCraney wanted to be a changed man. Mission Temple, reading Mormon history, reading Mormon books did not change him. He felt corrupt and desired a relationship with God. McCraney felt depressed until he listened to a radio program concerning being justified through righteousness. McCraney had tried to be worthy, but it failed. The pastor on the show stated that having Christ in your life will change your life, and you don't need to be worthy. McCraney, at that point, did the sinner's prayer and asked for forgiveness. McCraney then felt born again and that his life had changed. Of course, McCraney then went on to start his born-again Mormon ministry to assist Mormons to find this relationship with Christ. Many others I have read and talked with state a similar journey. That is, concern over sin that leads them down the path of becoming a born-again Christian. The concern is over Mormonism's emphasis on personal righteousness that they can never achieve. Of course, there are some modern Mormon scholars, such as Bob Millett and Steve Robinson, who are attempting to kind of reinvent that and make us more a grace church. But that's neither here nor there. Others that find peace in another faith tell an old common story. The individual began reading the Bible and began questioning the conflicts with Mormonism, and then they found the real Jesus and were saved. There's a recent RFM post that stated that precise story. Others leave over simply becoming offended by a fellow member or having some disagreement with how the church organization works. These people in many instances simply become inactive or do in fact find another faith that is less demanding and where the congregation is more friendly. On the other hand, they may also find that people are people regardless of their religious persuasion and don't find a home in another church. Others lose faith in religion, but not necessarily God. On a recent discussion board that I will be discussing in greater detail later, one person wrote, quote, "I actually lean towards belief as much as anyone. Since I can't trust the church of my youth or any other churches, that leaves me trusting in myself and God. And since I can't seem to find a pattern of God that yet makes sense, I'm left searching day by day," close quote. Narratives such as this one and by Sean McCraney are less common than the ones that are becoming atheist and agnostic. At least it seems to be so. Mormon radio talk show host Van Hale, who has been doing Mormon talk radio for 30 years, has recently stated that he does not get the same type of phone calls in recent years that he received back in the 1980s. In the 1980s, most ex-Mormon phone calls were from those trying to get Mormons to find the real Jesus and to be born again. Van Hale has stated in recent years that ex-Mormon atheism seems to have become the path most have taken, or at least they've become more vocal. In conversation with John DeLynn, who is well known for his for interviewing dissenters, also says that abandoning all faith has become the common path dissenters take. This is also true of the ex-Mormon conference, generally held in September or October. They seem to be dominated by this ex-Mormon atheist view. In addition, this seems true of the Recovery from Mormonism discussion board. My goal here is to discuss many reasons of why this seems to be the case. The origin of this paper comes from a discussion on the FAIR discussion board. One writer wrote about his personal experiences with ex-Mormons, quote, "Mormonism is unique in that most people I have known who leave religion altogether. They don't leave Mormonism because they were prompted to join a different religion. I would take issue with that this is unique to Mormonism, but that is not really the issue I'm discussing." In response to this post, another participant gave his possible reasons of why most leave religion altogether. He says, quote, "I believe that the majority of Mormon members who post here at the Recovery from Mormonism site categorize themselves as atheist agnostics. In my experience, when I struggled a great deal with faith in the church, the last place I wanted to turn to fill the void was another religion, Christian or otherwise. This is something I've mulled over quite a bit. Is there something particular about Mormonism that pushes those who leave out of religion entirely? Is Mormonism so deeply ingrained in many people that when they fall away, they cannot help throwing out the baby with the bathwater?" One responder posted these exact sentiments. Quote, "One thing that came to mind is the indoctrination of Mormonism being the only true church. From birth, I was taught that. I believed it. Now I find out that my long-held one true church isn't true anymore. Well, that chance, what is the chance that any of them are true? Pretty slim." Close quote. While the concept of Mormonism being the only true church certainly has something to do with rejecting religion in general, I believe the main reasons people leave the church and religion is a little different. The other reasons stated on the same thread fall into popular mythology. One responder stated three reasons people leave the church. One being because they desire to sin. The other because they have been blinded by anti-Mormon propaganda. And the last being due to laziness about going to church. In other words, there is no legitimate reason for leaving the church. Similar reasons are popular among believers of all faiths for why people embrace atheism or agnosticism. Many believers simply cannot comprehend the possibility of a person abandoning beliefs unless it is for selfish reasons or that the individual has been deceived in some manner. This is, of course, completely absurd. Other responders also believe that these three reasons for dissent to be ridiculous. One responder, I believe, really caught the essence of why many dissenters leave the church and religion in general. Quote, "The LDS faith makes as much sense as any other Christian church. So if I had some compelling reason to accept the Bible at face value, I might consider giving the LDS church as much a shot as any other. But part of my exit from the LDS church involved a certain amount of skepticism as some basic Christian tenets. If I question the role of the atonement itself, why in the world would I think the Catholics or Methodists would have a better answer? Well, I did at least spend time checking it all out, just for grins, but it's all mostly one and the same." Close quote. This post catches what I believe to be the number one reason why people that abandon belief in Mormonism do not embrace another faith, particularly another Christian religion. That is that the same intellectual problems they had with Mormonism carries over into other Christian faiths. It is defined in one simple sentence, "I will not be fooled again." One responder said this exactly. Quote, "Once you feel you've been made a fool of by one man-made religion, it's hard to put faith in another one." Close quote. This line of thought seems to be common among ex-Mormons. While arguments from Protestant critics such as Ed Decker, Gerald and Sandra Tanner, Walter Martin, John Ankerberg, James White, and an entire host of other critics used to be, if this is an appropriate way to put it, the champs of critically analyzing Mormonism, in modern times it has become secular arguments against Mormonism that seem to be winning most of those that leave. Secular critics of Mormonism, such as Brent Metcalf, Dan Vogel, Will Bagley, Michael Marquardt, Thomas Murphy, Bob McHugh, and many others, particularly those that publish with signature books, have simply replaced the Protestants as the most effective critics of Mormonism. Apologetic arguments put forth from the likes of Farms, Fair, and other independent apologists are also simply less effective when dealing with secular critics. Even the champion of modern Mormon apologetics, Dan Peterson, stated at the 2003 Fair Conference that secular, what he calls anti-Mormonism, is much more challenging to deal with. Demonstrating that Mormonism is biblical makes no difference to the secular critic. Also, no longer can the simple apologetic response turn the critical analysis of Mormonism back towards Christianity and the Bible as they have effectively done for a long time. In fact, evangelical and Protestant critics have made their criticism easy for apologists to respond to. Recently, Sean McCraney was on Van Hale's radio talk show, where Van Hale went on the offensive using the same arguments McCraney uses against Mormonism to attack McCraney's beliefs. Mr. McCraney was completely tongue-tied and did not know how to deal with the situation. This approach is totally ineffective with secular critics. Evangelical criticism doesn't only make it easy for apologists, but I have noticed that in many ways they have become instruments in assisting those that leave Mormonism to leave beliefs in God and the Bible altogether. While they bring many valid arguments against Mormonism to the forefront, they have ignored problems in their own tradition that the dissenter can see through very easily. Thus, those that leave Mormonism will not embrace being born again simply due to the fact that they have the exact same sort of intellectual problems with religious beliefs in general that they have had with Mormonism. There is no better recent example than the Jesus Christ Joseph Smith video to demonstrate how they are adding to this people leaving the religion in general. In the following, I'm going to demonstrate some of the reasons that dissenters have the same intellectual problems with other faiths, particularly born-again Christian, as they have with Mormonism, using evangelical criticisms. Certainly, these intellectual problems with Mormonism and overall Christianity do not necessarily come through viewing books or videos critical of Mormonism from Protestants. In fact, in reading ex-Mormon narratives, most do not. There are two reasons I'm going to take this approach. One is to demonstrate why evangelical criticisms add to Mormonism, Mormons abandoning all beliefs. And the second reason I'll get to afterwards. A video such as the Jesus Christ Joseph Smith video may raise the thinking of a potential dissenter, but it will not likely convert an intellectual seeker to Christianity. In the video, Joel Kramer says concerning the issue of DNA in the Book of Mormon, quote, "It's not an issue. The DNA issue of whether Native Americans come from Hebrew descent is not an issue. Once you get outside of Mormonism, it is not an issue. It's not a debate. Nobody's debating out in the scientific realm of whether or not Native Americans came from Israelites or Middle Easterners. Nobody." Close quote. Well, this is a true statement. However, the intellectual observer and potential dissenter will discover the same problem with the Bible. Just as DNA scientists are not debating the origin of Native Americans, they are also not debating whether or not humans only go back 6,000 years to Adam and Eve. They're not debating the DNA connection between chimpanzees and humans. It's there. They are not debating Neanderthals being a separate species from humans from DNA research. And they're not debating that DNA has been instrumental in confirming much of what we know about evolution from the fossil record. DNA presents the exact same problem for the Book of Genesis as it does for the Book of Mormon. In fact, you could do a DNA versus the Book of Genesis video and interview the exact same scientists from Living Hope Ministries video of DNA versus the Book of Mormon. These scientists would say the same basic thing. The problem the Book of Genesis presents is a far-reaching theological problem for many of these dissenters. Without Adam and Eve, there was no fall, and therefore no need for Christ. The video goes on and mentions that the God of Joseph Smith and the God of the Bible are different. A potential dissenter will discover that many of Joseph Smith's concepts about God do go beyond what the Bible says. But the honest seeker will also discover the New Testament goes beyond what the Old Testament taught. There is no Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in the Old Testament. This idea is entirely foreign to the Jewish tradition and are thus New Testament inventions. In fact, you could go even deeper in demonstrating how God evolves and develops in the Old Testament itself and the Jewish tradition, and in the Jewish tradition, as Karen Armstrong did in her book, A History of God. Contradictions in the Bible such as these are very popular in rejecting the Bible, not just by ex-Mormons, but also many Christian dissenters. Archaeological evidence for the Bible versus the Book of Mormon is also brought up in the movie in virtually all Protestant books that are critical of Mormonism. Any and all ex-Mormons will agree there is no credible evidence for the Book of Mormon. But to the majority of those that become atheists or agnostic, the claims of biblical verification is entirely hollow. Yes, it is true, Jerusalem is there, along with other biblical sites. However, to the intellectual seeker, this does not verify the Bible's supernatural claims any more than the fact that Nauvoo, Palmyra, and Kirtland exist verify Joseph Smith's prophetic call. Not to mention the stories of the Bible that do not have evidence, whether it be the entire book of Genesis or the massive exodus from Egypt. In fact, if you did a Doctrine and Covenants versus the Bible video, it would be the Bible that would come up way short of historical verification. Therefore, lack of real evidence for many ex-Mormons is just as true in any Christian faith. False prophecies of Joseph Smith is a favorite among ex-Mormons, as it is among evangelical criticisms as contained in the video. The video brings up such false prophecies as the temple being built in this generation, independence, and the mission of David Patton. Well, to the ex-Mormon, the Bible does no better. Prophecies of the coming of Jesus are very ambiguous in the Old Testament. There is a reason Jews still do not recognize Jesus as the promised Messiah. In addition, the Old Testament mentions that many of the Mosaic laws would be everlasting. It also states that David's empire would be everlasting and that the Israelites would dwell in the promised land, never to be removed. An angel told promised Samson's mother that Samson would begin to deliver the Israelites out of the hands of the Philistines, which did not happen. The video mentions that Jesus spoke prophetically concerning the destruction of the temple, laying aside the debate of whether or not this prophetic announcement was actually written before or after the temple destruction. Jesus also spoke prophetically with what he said concerning events around the second coming, that, quote, "Remember that all these things will happen before the people now living have all died." That's Matthew 24:34, and it's in today's English version. Concerning Joseph Smith's false prophecy about David Patton, Chip Thompson mentions he has heard excuses concerning his false prophecy and says the excuses don't hold any water. To the ex-Mormon, the excuses surrounding Jesus' false prophecy does not hold any water either, especially since the common notion of the biblical test for a prophet is 100% accuracy. Unfortunately, even Jesus fails the biblical test. Thus, once again, the ex-Mormon has the same difficulty of unfulfilled prophecies in other Christian faiths. Such issues can go on and on. Take Joseph Smith's involvement in the occult practices. Such practices may bother the dissenter. However, the number one book concerning this issue is Michael Quinn's book that contains 7 pages concerning occult practices by biblical prophets, including Jesus himself. Therefore, if Joseph Smith's involvement in magic or the occult bothers them to the extent they see atheists. Similar biblical practices also bother them. Evangelicals and Protestants assist in the trend of leading ex-Mormons into atheism in many other ways. There are a couple of Christian ministries that contain models of the gold plates that supposedly weighed what the gold plates weighed, that is 200 pounds. The notion being that there was no way Joseph could have ran through the woods carrying them while fighting off attackers. Setting aside the historical sources that say the plates weighed 50 to 60 pounds, the ex-Mormon doesn't find the story any less believable than Samson growing his magical head of hair and then being able to tear lions apart and killing hundreds of Philistines with a jawbone. As far as unbelievable stories, the ex-Mormon atheist has problems with all such unbelievable stories in all faiths, whether it be worldwide floods, Jonah and the whale. They have equal, or Muhammad flying to heaven on his horse. Ex-Mormon atheists are also just as troubled by the genocide and ethnic cleansing that God commanded Moses and Joshua to perform as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. They are also, if changes in the Book of Mormon trouble them, they are also troubled by the fact that the Bible has also undergone debate over what belongs in it, what don't. The original 1611 King James Bible contained the Apocrypha, now it don't. Those things are also throw a wrench into a book being infallible and inerrant. In the end, these ex-Mormons have the same problems with all Christian claims as they have with Mormonism. Once these beliefs in Joseph Smith and Jesus Christ crumble, rejecting any and all beliefs in God is the natural next step. The reason I have used these evangelical and Protestant examples of the mutual problems ex-Mormon atheists and agnostics have with religion is not only to demonstrate that they are a part of what assists ex-Mormons out of religion in general. As mentioned earlier, many of these mutual problems are used by Mormon apologists. Much of what I said concerning the Jesus Christ Joseph Smith video was part of the official response on the FAIR website. While such arguments do demonstrate that evangelicals do put their heads in the sand when it comes to their own faith, it does not help the Mormon position. In fact, it only worsens it. Many ex-Mormons talk about once being involved in apologetics. When the individual uses such apologetic tactics and then later becomes disenchanted with Mormonism, the ex-Mormon has already destroyed confidence in other Christian faiths, so naturally the person does not join another church. One responder wrote on the before-mentioned discussion board that, quote, "I would say there's a lot of reasons for this that ex-Mormons become atheists. For one, Mormons are very good at finding the shortfalls of other religions besides their own. Because of the extreme emphasis on only true church, Mormons seek to clearly understand why other religions are false and generally find good reasons well before they ever lose faith in their own." Another writer said a similar idea that, quote, "Mormons are already predisposed to be skeptical of other churches. Mormons correctly understand that the general Christian notion of the Bible being the final infallible word of God is untenable. Ex-Mormons don't flock to Protestantism or Catholicism because they retain their skepticism of these faiths they acquired as Mormons." A still faithful Mormon said this, quote, "If I were to find that indeed this church was false, I would think that agnosticism would be the only option for me. I know of too many flaws in mainstream Christian theology. As such, I don't think I would have anywhere to go. I would still believe in God, but I just would not know what to believe." Close quote. As I said, abandoning belief in God is the natural next step after being disillusioned in your faith. Many disenchanted Mormons have simply already logically destroyed the beliefs of other faiths. As I said earlier, it is secular arguments that cause people to abandon belief. At least it seems to be growing. Many of the previous arguments I spoke of that evangelicals themselves use against Mormonism are actually secular in nature, such as DNA, lack of evidence for the Book of Mormon, etc. And it is these secular arguments that concern a lack of evidence that leads them out. Not that Mormonism doesn't square with the Almighty Bible, or that they don't have the correct Jesus. Many say that both the Mormon Jesus and Christian Jesus are equally imaginary. One ex-Mormon wrote, quote, "Indeed, many ex-LDS do become agnostic secular after leaving because of the nature of the arguments that destroyed their faith, secular arguments. The biggest controversies to LDS truth claims are secular arguments. Once the triple hammer of secularism crushes your LDS belief system, it crushes the related foolishness of Christianity and finally theism altogether. This is why you almost never see ex-LDS joining other religions. The same issues that shredded your LDS belief decimate other religions with even less effort. After jettisoning the absurdity of Mormonism, there is little reason to replace that void with something even more silly. Close quote. In addition to secular arguments that persuade ex-Mormons from joining other faiths, atheism seems to be on the rise worldwide and even in the United States. In some ways, it almost seemed like a fad. Atheist books by Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris all made national bestseller lists. In addition to these specific atheist books, books by secular biblical scholars such as Bart Ehrman and John Crossan have become increasingly popular. Programs about Jesus and biblical stories on the History and Discovery channels are dominated by secular biblical scholars. Wade Roof, this past Thursday night, mentioned that agnosticism is growing in America among young people, but not necessarily atheism. However, he did point out in relation to a question I asked that it has to do with how one defines atheism versus agnosticism. Secularism seems to be simply growing. It is rampant in Western Europe. Polls show that in Great Britain, only about 61% believe in God. Take in mind that polls are not a fine science and that different polls can say different things according to the way the question is asked. But I think it shows an indication of what's going on. Others have Great Britain and other European countries below 50% of the population believe in God. I've seen polls that demonstrate a similar number in France, and some polls show it even lower. While the United States still hovers around a 90% believe in God, there has been a recent buzz concerning a decline in belief. A recent survey demonstrated that belief in God is declining at a greater rate among younger Americans. In 1986, polls showed that 11% of 18 to 25-year-olds did not believe in God. In 2007, the survey, the number jumped to 20%. According to this survey, overall American belief in God is actually only 73%, well below other surveys. This poll says that it is the manner in which they ask the questions as a physical God versus spiritual and things like that as an explanation of why the number was lower in this particular survey. And in this survey, it was also dramatically lower among other countries. Other surveys also demonstrate that belief in God is lower among the younger generation. And of course, polls have shown for years that the higher education one attains, the less one believes in God. Richard Bushman met with a group of us at the University of Utah back in 2006, where Bushman said that believing God in the academic world is becoming more and more taboo. The point is that atheism and agnosticism is catching fire in society. Not only that, but atheists are becoming increasingly more aggressive, as evidenced by the books already mentioned. In addition, in October, the long-awaited anti-religion documentary from comedian Bill Maher will be released. Bill Maher, of course, has a successful show on HBO where he rarely passes on opportunities to make fun of religion. With atheism and agnosticism growing in our culture, it is only natural that the number of ex-Mormon atheists and agnostics would also grow. Another point important to this discussion that must be pointed out is the fact that the manner in which religion is presented many times does not square with the facts. Many people with religious faith have a fundamentalist view. When that fundamentalist view does not stand up to scrutiny, everything crumbles from this point of view. When at church the scriptures are presented as literal, people grow up with the perception that the Indians are Lamanites, the worldwide flood really happened, Adam and Eve were the actual first people on earth, and a literal talking snake appeared to them, etc., etc. Michael Ashe's new book, Shaken Faith Syndrome, touches on this issue and states it very well. Ashe says, quote, "Such a black and white fundamentalist mindset can set us up for problems. There either were horses in the ancient Americas, the fundamentalist mind may think, or the Book of Mormon is false. There either was a worldwide flood that wiped out virtually all life, or the Bible is false." Close quote. Of course, as Ashe points out, there are reinterpretive ways to explain these and other issues. To the ex-Mormons, The atheist ex-Mormon's such reinterpretive attempts are a sign of desperation, entirely reject reinventing scriptural stories and tradition. Another very personal reason that leads people from faith that I definitely can relate to is the failure of prayer and God demonstrating his existence. Hospitals are full of people suffering from disease. Suffering from disease is not a result of free agent of the free agency of man. It is a result of God's imperfect creation, according to many of these ex-Mormons. Well, that's the argument they use. They don't really believe God created, but that's what they... It's an argument they use against believers. Priesthood blessings and Christian prayers of all faiths are no more effective in healing disease than lucky horseshoes or rabbit's feet. Many ex-Mormons online fanatically argue that prayer is a superstition due to its ineffectiveness. To them, prayer is a waste of time, no matter what religion it is. In the final analysis, according to the ex-Mormons' narratives and all the ones that I've talked with, the major problem is a lack of evidence. There is no evidence for any supernatural claim, whether it be the resurrection of Jesus, Muhammad's trip to heaven, Joseph Smith's prophetic call, and any other supernatural claim out there. If lack of evidence drives someone from Mormonism, then that same lack of evidence for any and all faiths drives the ex-Mormon to become atheist or agnostic. For many of these ex-Mormons, becoming atheist or agnostic is the only logical route that a sinner can take. Thank you.
Well, those were wonderful papers. We have about 15 minutes for questioning. If you would come up to the microphone and state your question.
I am addressing particularly Mr. Wimmer, but it may pertain to Mr. Payne as well. I think your research has been very lopsided. I came down the hill from Ensign Ward 28 years ago to St. Mark's Cathedral, where I discovered that about a quarter of all the people who attend there have some association with the Mormon Church. And I know there's one other person in this room who has a ministry right now in another local church where there are many Mormons. If you're doing your research on the internet, you're going to find fundamentalist points of view. But most of the Mormons I know, of which there are a great many at St. Mark's Cathedral, don't write papers about it. They don't vent about it. They're very happy where they are. They retain their faith. That was certainly my experience. I grew up in a non-religious home. I was sent to church. My parents were Jack Mormons. They never talked about religion, no Bible, no Book of Mormon, no prayer, no grace at meals. But I went to Sunday school, and I gained a faith in Jesus from the Mormon Church. I didn't lose that. I just transferred it to a place where I felt more comfortable. I invite you to look into other religions, not just Christian, and find that there are a great multitude of Mormons who have made the transition quite well. In the earliest parish register of St. Mark's, which is the oldest church in continuous use in Utah, it's founded in 1870, the first bishop, Bishop Tuttle, wrote in red the origin of those who were coming, and Mormon is about every fifth person there. So there is another story.
I think just to clarify, so my particular study focused on the sociological apostate, and so what you're describing would be considered switching or leave-taking according to the typology. And so, no, I did not consider those who switch or leave. There's been plenty of studies done on that. So the numbers I presented here are strictly talking about the narratives of those who have made a clear break with the Mormon Church and been vocal about it. There's plenty, of course, that switch all the time and move to other traditions. Those I just didn't consider those. Those were outside the scope of what I was looking at. So,
Certainly, your experience could be different than mine. I kind of try to say at the beginning that, you know, this ain't really a fine science and able to determine where most go. But it does seem that those who find atheism or Gnosticism, they're at least becoming more vocal. The ex-Mormon conference is dominated by these people. This could have been true of the amounts that go to another religion versus leave religion 30 years ago. They just weren't as vocal. It's hard to determine. I know in my own personal experience, in my own family, a little over half of my brothers and sisters have left Mormonism. They haven't been excommunicated or anything. And not one of them believe in God, period. And most people around me that knows, I've never actually personally known one that went to another faith. So, I mean, yeah, it's a reflection of my experience and what I've seen.
I just wanted to respond to the issue of Christ, and that I'm an agnostic simply because I can never really feel sure about anything. I think it's genetic. But I do love, I did pull out of Mormonism beautiful teachings on Christ, which I still sort of embrace just because I liked them, and still practice a kind of stumbling Christianity outside of congregation. So I think that regardless of, you know, that there are various leaders who inspire us, probably Buddha would inspire me if I would take the time to read about him. I just am too lazy.
I just want to clarify the statement you made that that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit were not referenced in the Old Testament. Were you stating at that point that it was atheists that believed that, or what were you speaking of? Because I can find all three of them in the Old Testament.
Yes, that is what an atheist would say. That's what a secular biblical scholar would say, like John Cross, and he goes at that very aggressively. The argument would be is that if you're finding him there, it's because you're reading him into it, whereas if you just read the Old Testament isolated from the New, it wouldn't be there. And there's a reason Jews don't see it either. That would be the argument.
I usually read RFM every Sunday so that I can find out the news that I didn't hear because I didn't go to church. And the people who did will post anything if it's very interesting. I suspect that the reason RFM is very dominated by atheists and agnostics is that they really drive Christians out. I've seen sometimes when Christians post things and the atheists and agnostics are ruthless in criticizing them. So I think it's probably not a very comfortable place for them to be. So I doubt that we can draw very much conclusion about percentages and where people go based on RFM. That's not to say we can't draw them from some other places. But also, I live in Cedar City, and I've heard that the Presbyterian church there, that a third of their congregation is former Mormon. So that's even higher than the 25%. What? Oh, RFM, well, that's what we're talking about, Recovery from Mormonism, exmormon.org, yeah.
I really like both of yours, and I think it's very interesting ways. Said the course, you were very well. Both of you, it's very minimal, it's small, it's first steps, whatever else. I know my dad, in dealing with one of the local Protestant ministers in Provo, they always got together every Easter. They get to do a thing, whatever else. This story is very interesting because he says, "Well, I'm here as a Protestant minister in Provo. Of course, largely Protestant ministers earn their living by." I guess in his church, it's not only a stipend from the general body of the church itself, but also donations. And a lot of people who leave Mormonism apparently don't like to give donations to the church. And so he actually kind of gets the shaft because he's the minister here. Perhaps a suggestion, if we want to continue this, would be to to look at Catholic and Protestant churches here in Utah and other predominantly Mormon areas and talk to their leaders and pastors to see, because they would have a good idea. Again, maybe it's not as scientific as we want, but it would certainly add another color to both the narratives that you're both kind of talking about. And I think that would be a very interesting, just a thought for a way you could continue perhaps this project of what happens to ex-Mormons, because they're around. There are a lot of them here that go to churches, which is another place perhaps to start adding some more dimensions to the ex-Mormon narrative project that I think you both demonstrated very interestingly today. So, just a thought.
I think that'd be a very good idea. I mean, Nadine's right. Recovery from Mormonism, they are brutal, if you believe in God. I mean, there is this separate thread that's supposed to be for the Mormons that became Christian, but, she's right. They're probably not very comfortable there. This is... I didn't get everything I'm talking about from recovery from Mormonism. I got a lot from personal experience and just people I've talked with and other people who have kind of been out there among a lot of ex-Mormons. And like I said, it's not a fine science. There's no way to really determine where the amount of people that ex-Mormons go, especially since most don't ever actually get excommunicated. They just leave. And so it'd be difficult to ever actually get at this finally. But trying to is a lot of fun, as we're doing.
Hi. I would just like to address the issue of a supernatural God as opposed to a natural or fleshly God. And I think that whole aspect, that dichotomy, if you will, is really the issue here. It's whether or not you believe in a God of flesh and bone or a God who's supernatural spirit.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of the discussion, and I think that so when I have discussions with ex-Mormons, whether they be Protestant, Christian, or agnostic, atheist, whatever, they have a very difficult time comprehending of the concept of a liberal Protestant, and so I suppose my 3 years at Yale have tainted me that way, where my professor, my faculty advisor, a lifelong Methodist minister, says to me, I don't know if Jesus is divine, and I don't know if he was resurrected. I just live by his teachings. And that is a... liberal Protestantism seems to be, my impression, I have no data to support this, seems to be somewhat unknown in the West. Certainly it was new to me as I went out to the East Coast. I went, wow, you're a Christian and you don't believe in Jesus, or Jesus' divinity necessarily. They don't necessarily reject it. And the same could be said of my biblical scholar professors as well. So I do think you're right. There is an issue at that. But I also think that this whole concept of being a liberal Christian or a liberal believer, where maybe we're agnostic about certain supernatural claims, we don't reject them necessarily, but we say, I don't know. But what I do know is that I'm inspired by the teachings of Jesus, and I'm inspired by the Book of Mormon or the Four Gospels or whatever, and I'm not really concerned about whether they're historical or not, which is a very, very liberal Protestant point of view. I think that's foreign to a lot of people, but very common amongst other segments of the population. So I think that might factor in as well.
I just want to make a quick comment to echo that and the former questioner's question, and that is, to put it succinctly, as a client of mine once said, when I left Mormonism and I joined a sort of a classic Protestant church, I had to buy into less science fiction, and the science fiction that I had to buy into, I was able to interpret in my own way.
Well, it appears we have used up all of our questions. It is 10 after 6, so if we have no further questions, then I will close the session. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, presenters, for such wonderful papers.